Chapter 16. Thursday, September 18th. I'm at my desk, tying up some loose ends when Ellen runs up to me, holding an email printout. It's from Dick, raising the alarm with all company executives that something has gone terribly wrong with the company invoicing systems. Earlier today, one of the clerks discovered that no customers had been invoiced for 3 days. Among other things, this means that customers haven't been paying on time, which means the company will have less cash in the bank at the end of the quarter than projected, which will raise all sorts of uncomfortable questions when the company earnings are announced. It's clear from Dick's string of emails that he's livid, and apparently his whole accounts receivable staff and controller have been chain-smoking and doing damage control at all levels. From Dick Landry to Steve Masters, CC Bill Palmer. Date September 18th, 3:11 p.m. Priority, highest. Subject, action needed. Potential $50 million cash shortfall due to IT failure.
All customer invoices are still stuck or missing in the system. We can't even retrieve them to manually send invoices by email. We're trying to figure out how we can resume normal business operations. There's likely $50 million of receivables stuck in the system, which will be missing from our cash account at end of quarter. Get your IT guys to fix this. The hole this blows in our quarterly numbers will be impossible to hide, and maybe even impossible to explain away. Call me, Steve. I'll be on the window ledge. Dick.
We're all gathered in the NOC conference room. I'm pleased that when Patty finishes describing the incident, she quickly presented all the relevant changes for the last 72 hours. After she's done, I say firmly to the entire team, "First and foremost on my mind is the risk of losing transactions. Ladies and gentlemen, I need to be very clear about this. Do not touch anything without getting approval from me. This is not an outage we're dealing with here. We're in a situation where we could accidentally lose order entry or accounts receivable data. This terrifies me. And that should absolutely terrify you." As Patty said, we need timelines and hypotheses for what might have caused the invoicing system to fail, I say. This is our Apollo 13 moment, and I'm Gene Kranz in Houston Mission Control. I don't want guesswork. I want hypotheses backed up with facts. So get back to your screens, assemble timelines and data, and I want to hear your best thinking on cause and effect. Failure is not an option. By 6 p.m., Patty's team has documented over 20 different potential failure causes that have been proposed. After further investigation, 8 remain as likely possibilities. An owner has been assigned to look into each. Realizing that there's little more we can do as a group until they complete their research, we agree to reconvene at 10 p.m. tonight. On the one hand, I'm frustrated that once again we've been plunged into a crisis and our day is dominated by unplanned incident work. On the other hand, I feel a deep sense of satisfaction at the orderly nature of our incident investigation and quickly text Paige that I'll be joining the family for dinner shortly. "Daddy," I hear as I'm sitting in bed with Grant, trying to put him to sleep while keeping the thoughts of outages out of my head. "Why doesn't Thomas the Tank Engine have a tender car? Why?" Smiling down at him, I marvel at the questions my 3-year-old son comes up with. We're going through our nighttime ritual of reading books. I'm glad to be doing this again, which I do every night. Or did, that is, until the Phoenix recovery effort. Most of the lights are off, but one lamp is still dimly lit. There is a pile of books on Grant's bed, and we're on the third one of the night. I'm starting to get a little dry-mouthed from reading. The idea of taking a little break and doing some research on the internet on train tender cars sounds pretty appealing. I love how inquisitive my kids are, and how much they love books. But there are nights when I'm so exhausted that I've actually fallen asleep during our nightly ritual. My wife will walk in, find me asleep with one of Grant's books lying on top of my face, and Grant asleep beside me. Despite how tired I am, I'm grateful to be at home early enough to resume my nighttime ritual with my older son.
"Yes, we need to find out, Daddy," Grant demands.
I smile at him, and I dig my phone out from my pocket, intending to do a Google search for tank engine tender car. But first, I quickly scan my phone for any new updates on the customer invoicing problem. I'm amazed at the difference 2 weeks can make. During the last SEV1 incident that hit our credit card processing systems, the conference call was full of finger-pointing, denials, and, most importantly, wasted time when our customers couldn't give us money. Afterward, we did the first of a series of ongoing blameless postmortems to figure out what really happened and come up with ideas on how to prevent it from happening again. Better yet, Patty led a series of mock incident calls with all hands on deck to rehearse the new procedures. It was terrific to watch. Even Wes saw the value. I'm pleased to see all the emails indicating a lot of good information and effective discussion among the teams working the problem. They've kept the telephone conference bridge and a chat room open for people working the issue, and I plan on calling in at 10 p.m. to see how it's going. That's 45 minutes from now. Plenty of time to spend with Grant, who should be falling asleep soon. He nudges me, obviously expecting more progress on the research front. "Sorry, Granty. Daddy got distracted," I say as I open up the browser. I'm surprised by how many of the search results are all about Thomas the Tank Engine. It's the book series that spawned a multi-billion-dollar franchise of toy trains, clothing, videos, and coloring books. With two sons, we seem destined to own two of every item soon. I'm reading a promising Wikipedia entry on trains when my phone starts vibrating and the screen displays, "Call from Steve Masters." I groan and double-check my watch. It's 9:15 p.m. I've had way too many meetings and phone calls with Steve lately. In my head, I wonder how many of these meetings I can take. On the other hand, after the Phoenix debacle, every outage and incident is trivial in comparison, right? I say gently, "Hang on, Grant. Daddy has to take a phone call. I'll be right back." I jump out of his bed and walk into the dark hallway. I'm glad I had just scanned through all the email traffic on the outage just seconds before. I take a deep breath before I hit the button to answer the call. I say, "Bill here." Steve's loud voice booms in my ear. "Evening, Bill. I'm glad you're there. Of course you know about the customer invoicing problems from Dick." "Yes, of course," I reply, surprised at his tone. "My team declared a major incident early this afternoon, and we've been working this issue ever since. I've been sending out status reports every hour. Dick and I spent 20 minutes on the phone earlier this evening. I know the problem is serious, and my team is following the process we've created after the payroll failure. I'm completely satisfied that the process is working." "Well, I just got off the phone with Dick, and he tells me that you're dragging your feet," says Steve, clearly very angry. "Obviously, I'm not calling you at night because I want to chit-chat. Do you understand how intolerable this is? Yet another IT screw-up jeopardizing everything. Cash is the lifeblood of this company, and if we can't invoice customers, we can't get paid." Falling back on old training on handling frustrated people, I calmly reiterate what I already stated. "As I said, I talked with Dick earlier today. He's very much impressed upon me all the implications. We've activated our new incident process, and we're methodically looking into what could have caused the failure. They're doing exactly what I want them to, because with so many moving pieces, it's way too easy to make things worse by jumping to conclusions." "Are you in the office?" Steve demands, cutting me off before I could finish. His question genuinely catches me off guard. No, I'm at home," I answer. Is he worried that I've delegated the problem away? To reinforce my role in handling the crisis and what my expectations from my team are, I say, "I will be calling into the Warbridge line at 10 o'clock. As always, we have a duty officer on site, and those on my staff who need to be in the office are there already." Finally, I ask bluntly, "Steve, want to tell me what's on your mind? I'm on top of this situation. What do you need that you aren't getting right now?" He responds hotly, "What I need from you is some sense of urgency. Dick and his team are burning the midnight oil, trying to figure out how our quarter will end up in 6 working days. But I think I already know what the answer will be. He continues, we'll probably miss almost every target that we've promised the board. Revenue, cash, receivables, everything. In fact, every measure we've promised the board is going the wrong way. This screw-up may confirm the board's suspicion that we've completely lost control of managing this company. Steve is almost snarling now as he says, so, what I want from you, Bill, is to stay sufficiently on top of things so that I don't have my CFO saying that you're dragging your feet. The house is burning down, and all I hear from you is about drawing pictures and timelines. What in the hell is wrong with you? You afraid to get people out of bed? I start again. Steve, if I thought it would help, I'd have everyone pull all-nighters in the data center tonight. For Phoenix, some people didn't go home for nearly a week. Trust me, I know the house is on fire, but right now, more than anything, we need situational awareness. Before we send the teams crashing through the front door with fire hoses, we have to have someone at least quickly walk the perimeter of the yard. Otherwise, we'll end up burning down the houses next door. I realize that I've raised my voice in the relative quiet of our house as we're trying to get the kids to sleep. I resume, more quietly. And just in case you forgot, during the payroll outage, we made the outage worse by our own actions. We probably could have completed the payroll run during the business day if someone hadn't started screwing with the SAN. Because of that, we added another 6 hours to the outage, and we nearly lost payroll data. My hopes that the calm voice of reason is reaching him are dashed when I hear him say, oh yeah? I don't think your team agrees with you. What was the name of that smart guy who you introduced me to? Bob? No, Brent. I talked with Brent earlier today, and he's very skeptical of your approach. He thinks what you're doing is separating people who actually do the work from what needs to get done. What is Brent doing right now? Shit. I like transparency. I always try to make my team totally accessible to my boss and the business, but there's always risk in doing this. Like having Brent spout off his crazy theories to the CEO. I hope Brent is at home, because that's exactly where he should be, I respond. Until we know for sure exactly what went wrong, that's where I want him. Look, it's rocket scientists like him that often cause the problem in the first place. Every time we escalate to Brent, we perpetuate our reliance on him, and make it that much less likely we can fix things without him. Suspecting that I may be losing Steve, I start again. The chaotic way we currently work, Brent is having to fix the punctured hulls almost every day. I'm pretty sure, though, that Brent is one of the main reasons the hull is punctured in the first place. It's not malicious, of course, but it's just a side effect of the way we work and fix outages here. There is a pause. Then he says slowly and decisively, I'm glad you're being so professorial about this, but we've got a wildfire that's out of control. Up until now, we've done it your way, and now we're going to do it my way. I want you to call Brent in, and I want him to roll up his sleeves and help fix this outage. And not just Brent. I want all eyeballs on screens and all hands on keyboards. I'm Captain Kirk, you're Scotty, and I need warp speed, so get your lazy engineers off their asses. Do you understand me? Steve is yelling so loudly by now that I'm holding the phone away from my ear. Suddenly, I'm furious. Steve is going to screw this up again. Recalling my days in the Marines, I finally say, Permission to speak freely, sir? I hear Steve on the other end of the line snort dismissively in response, Yes, damn it. You think I'm being overly cautious, that I'm hesitating to do what needs to be done? But you are wrong, dead wrong, I say adamantly. If you do what I think you're suggesting, which is basically all hands on deck, I predict that we're going to make things much worse. I continue. I tried to advise you of something very similar before the Phoenix launch. Up until now, we have not been sufficiently disciplined in how we work outages. Given all the complexity and moving pieces, there's too much likelihood of causing another problem. I may not know exactly what caused the customer invoicing issue, but I know enough to absolutely conclude that what you're proposing is a very bad idea. I recommend continuing along the lines I am currently prosecuting. I hold my breath, waiting to hear how he reacts. He says slowly, I'm sorry you feel that way, Bill, but the drawer's open on my side of the desk. I'm telling you that it's now DEFCON 1, so go get the smartest people working on this problem, and I want status updates on this IT failure every 2 hours until it's fixed. Understood? Before I can think about what to say, I find myself saying, I don't know why you need me to do that. You're talking directly to my people, and you're calling all shots on the ground. Do it yourself. I can't be held responsible for the results of this FUBAR situation. And before I hang up on him, I say with finality, and expect my resignation in the morning. I wipe the sweat off my forehead and look up from my phone to see my wife Paige staring at me wide-eyed.
Are you insane? You just quit, just like that? How are we going to pay the bills now? She asks, her voice rising.
I turn the ringer off on my phone and put it back in my pocket, saying, Honey, I'm not sure how much of that conversation you heard, but let me explain. Part 2. Chapter 17. Monday, September 22nd. In the 4 days since quitting, Paige has been fretting endlessly. On the other hand, I'm amazed at how much better I'm sleeping at night, as if some huge hidden weight has been lifted from my shoulders. Uninterrupted by emails or emergency pages, the weekend was incredibly peaceful. I was still receiving them on Thursday, but I just deleted the email accounts and blocked the text messages. It felt great. I tell Paige not to take Grant to her mother's. Instead, I'm taking him on an adventure. Paige reacts with a bemused smile and helps me pack his Thomas the Tank Engine backpack. By 8 a.m., we're out of the house and heading happily to the train station, where, for months, I've been promising to take him. For an hour, we watch trains go by, and I'm continually amazed at Grant's unabashed joy. Despite the uncertainty around what I'll be doing next, I feel blessed that I can share this moment with Grant. As I'm taking pictures of Grant screaming with delight and pointing at the diesel trains going by, I realize how few pictures I've taken of either of my kids in the last month. We're still watching the trains when my phone rings. It's Wes. I let it roll to voicemail. He calls several more times, and each time he leaves another voicemail. Then Patty calls, which I let roll to voicemail too. After three more calls, I mutter in exasperation, Come on, guys. Palmer, I answer the phone.
Bill, we just heard the news from Steve, I hear Patty say, sounding like she's on speakerphone.
With surprising anger in her voice, she continues,
I've got Wes here, and we're both completely shocked. We knew something wasn't right when you didn't show up for our regular cab meeting on Friday. I just can't believe you resigned during this outage, and after everything we've achieved.
Look, guys, it has nothing to do with you, I explain. Steve and I just had some irreconcilable differences about how to resolve the big invoicing failure. I'm sure you guys will do fine without me. As I say the last part, I feel slightly disingenuous.
Well, we've pretty much screwed the pooch since you left, Wes says, sounding genuinely abashed, confirming my worst fears. Steve insisted that we bring in all the engineers, including Brent. He said he wanted a sense of urgency and hands-on keyboards, not people sitting on the bench. Obviously, we didn't do a good enough job coordinating everyone's efforts, and...
Wes doesn't finish his sentence. Patty picks up where he left off.
We don't know for sure, but at the very least, the inventory management systems are now completely down, too. No one can get inventory levels in the plants or warehouses, and they don't know which raw materials we need to replenish. All the finance guys are about to jump from window ledges because they may not be able to close the books for the quarter on time. With all these systems down, no one has the data they need to compute cost of goods sold, gross profit, and net margin.
Holy shit. Speechless for a moment, I finally say,
that's incredible.
Grant grabs at my phone, demanding my attention. I say, look, guys, I'm with my son, and we're in the middle of something important. I can't talk for very long. But rest assured that I'm really proud of everything that we've done together, and I know that you guys can get through this crisis without me.
That's a load of junk, and you know it, Patty says. How can you leave us in the lurch like this? We have so many things that we planned on fixing together, and you're leaving it all completely unfinished. I never figured you as someone who would quit like this.
I agree. Leaving now is pretty shitty, if you ask me, Wes says, chiming in. I sigh. I'm never going to tell them about all the frustrating and absurd meetings I've had to put up with Steve. That's between him and me. I'm sorry to let you down, but it's something that I had to do, I say. You'll do just fine. Just don't let Steve or anyone else micromanage you. No one knows the IT systems like you guys do, so don't let anyone try to call the shots, okay? I hear Wes mutter, too late for that. By now, Grant is trying to hang up my phone. Guys, I've gotta run. We'll catch up later, okay? Over beers. Yeah, sure, Wes says.
Gee, thanks for everything, Patty says. Catch you around.
With that, the line disconnects. I let out a long sigh. Then, looking at Grant, I put away my phone and give him my full attention again, intent on recapturing our moment of happiness before it was interrupted. My phone rings again on our drive home. Grant is asleep in the back seat. This time, it's Steve. Having no interest in talking with him just yet, I let it go to voicemail. 3 times. I pull into our garage and get out of the car, trying to get Grant out of his seat without waking him up. As I walk through the house with him, I see Paige. I point to Grant, silently mouthing to her, asleep. I pad softly up the stairs, at last transferring him to his bed and taking off his shoes. With a sigh of relief, I close the door behind me and walk back downstairs. When Paige sees me, she says, that bastard Steve called me this morning. I almost hung up on him, but he gave me a long story about doing all this soul-searching with some guy named Eric. He says he has a proposition for you. I told him I'd pass along the message. When I roll my eyes, she says in a suddenly concerned voice, look, I know you resigned because you felt it was the right thing to do, but you know as well as I do that there aren't many other companies in town that pay as well as Parts Unlimited, especially after your promotion. I don't want to move away from my family. She looks levelly at me. Honey, I know he's a bastard, but we both still need to earn a living. Promise me that you'll listen to what Steve has to say and keep an open mind, okay? Bill? Okay?
I merely nod and step into the dining room, hitting the speed dial for Steve. Steve answers his cell phone on the first ring. Good afternoon, Bill. Thanks for calling me back. I had the pleasure of talking with your wife, telling her all about what a jackass I've been.
Yeah, she said something to that effect, I respond. She said that you really wanted to talk.
I hear him say, look, I wanted to apologize for the way I've behaved since you graciously accepted my request to become our VP of IT operations. Dick thought I was crazy when I told him that I was going to have IT report to me, but I told him about how, when I first became a plant manager many decades ago, I worked on the assembly line for a month just to make sure that I understood the ins and outs of daily life of everyone who worked there. I promised Dick that I would get my hands dirty and not just delegate the problem away. I'm angry with myself that I haven't lived up to that promise, and delegating all the IT issues to Sarah was a total screw-up. Listen, I know I haven't been fair to you, especially when you've fulfilled your end of the bargain. You've been a straight shooter, and you've genuinely tried to prevent bad things from happening. He pauses for a couple of moments. Look, I just got kicked in the ass by Eric and by the entire audit committee. He held my feet to the fire until I finally understood something. It made me realize that I've been doing something really wrong for many years, and I want to make it right. In short, I'd like you to resume your role as VP of IT operations, effective immediately. I'd like to work with you, as Eric coined it, as the two sides of a dysfunctional marriage. Maybe the two of us together can figure out what is really going wrong with how IT is managed here at Parts Unlimited. I'm convinced that IT is a competency that we need to develop here. All I'm asking is that you spend 90 days with me and give it a try. And if at the end of the 90 days you still want to bail, then you can do so, with a 1-year severance package. Remembering my promise to Paige, I choose my words carefully. You've been pretty consistent in being, as you say, a complete jackass for the past month. I've been very consistent in presenting to you my analysis and recommendations over and over again. And each time, you've crapped on it. Why should I trust you now? 45 minutes later, after Steve continually tries to woo me back, I hang up the phone and go back into the kitchen where Paige is waiting to hear what happened. Chapter 18, Tuesday, September 23rd. The next morning, I'm driving into work at 6:30 a.m. for Steve's IT leadership off-site. He's calling it an off-site, even though the meeting is in Building 2. Earlier this morning, I padded softly into Grant and Parker's rooms to say goodbye. Watching Parker sleep, I kissed him and whispered softly, "Sorry that Daddy couldn't take you on an adventure today. It was your turn, but Daddy has to go back to work. This weekend, I promise." "This better be worth it, Steve." The meeting is in the corporate boardroom. Walking on to the 15th floor, I still can't believe how different it is than all the other buildings. Chris, Wes, and Patty are already there, all holding coffee cups and plates full of pastries. Patty barely acknowledges my presence. Wes greets me loudly, saying sarcastically, "Hey, Bill, nice to see you. I hope you don't quit again today." "Thanks, Wes." Chris acknowledges me with an understanding smile, rolling his eyes and making the motions of getting a beer. I nod and smile and turn to the back of the room. My mood brightens when I see the Vandal Donuts in back, and I start loading up my paper plate. As I'm trying to decide whether having 6 donuts on my plate is a breach of social protocol, I feel a hand clap me on my shoulder. It's Steve. "Good to see you again, Bill. I'm glad you're here." Looking down at my overflowing plate, he laughs loudly. "Why not just take the entire platter with you?" "Good idea." "Glad to be here," I reply. Eric takes a seat right across from me, saying, "Morning, Bill." Behind him is a large suitcase that he had lugged in. I squint at the suitcase. The last time I saw a suitcase without wheels was in my mother's attic 20 years ago. Eric's hair is dripping wet, soaking the shoulders of his denim shirt. Was he running late this morning and had to run out of his hotel without drying his hair? Or does he look like this every morning? Where exactly did Steve find this guy? "Good morning," Steve says, addressing the room. "First, I appreciate everyone making it here so early, especially since I know that you and your teams have been working incredibly long hours over the last 2 weeks."
"Ha!" Eric snorts. "That's probably the understatement of the century."
Everyone laughs nervously, going to extra lengths to not make eye contact with anyone else. Steve smiles sadly. "I know that the last couple of weeks have been harrowing. I now realize just how much responsibility I bear for all of this. Not just for the Phoenix disaster, but everything leading up to the audit issues, the customer invoicing and inventory failures over the last couple of days, and the trouble we're having with the auditors. He stops, obviously distraught and needing a moment to compose himself. Is he tearing up? Now here's a side of Steve you don't see every day. What the heck happened to Steve after I left? He puts down an index card that he's been holding, shrugs his shoulders, and gestures to Eric. Eric described the relationship between a CEO and a CIO as a dysfunctional marriage, that both sides feel powerless and held hostage by the other. His fingers worry at the card. There are two things I've learned in the last month. One is that IT matters. IT is not just a department that I can delegate away. IT is smack in the middle of every major company effort we have and is critical to almost every aspect of daily operations. He says, I know that right now nothing, absolutely nothing, is more important to the company's success than how this leadership team performs. The second thing I've learned is that my actions have made almost all of our IT problems worse. I turned down Chris and Bill's requests for more budget, Bill's request for more time to do Phoenix right, and micromanaged things when I wasn't getting the results I wanted. Steve then looks at me. The person I wronged the most was Bill. He told me things that I didn't want to hear, and I shut him down. In hindsight, he was completely right, and I was completely wrong. And for that, Bill, I'm very sorry. I see Wes's jaw drop open. Completely embarrassed, I merely say, all water under the bridge now. Like I said to you yesterday, Steve, apology not expected, but appreciated. Steve nods and looks at his card for several moments. The huge challenges ahead of us will require an outstanding team operating at their absolute best. Yet, we don't completely trust one another. I know that I am partially to blame, but that needs to end now. Over the weekend, I thought back on my career, which, as you may know, could end at any moment, as my board has made clear. I know that my most rewarding times were always when I was part of a great team. That goes for both my professional and personal life. A great team doesn't mean that they had the smartest people. What made those teams great is that everyone trusted one another. It can be a powerful thing when that magic dynamic exists. Steve continues, one of my favorite books about team dynamics is Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. He writes that in order to have mutual trust, you need to be vulnerable. So, I'm going to tell you a little about myself and what makes me tick. And then I'm going to ask you to do the same. It may make you uncomfortable, but it's part of what I need from you as leaders. If you can't do it for yourself, do it for the livelihood of the nearly 4,000 Parts Unlimited employees and their families. I don't take that responsibility lightly, and you shouldn't either. Oh, shit. That's another part of management offsites I forgot about. Touchy-feely crap. Steve ignores the skyrocketing tension in the room as everyone, like me, puts up their deflector shields. My family was dirt poor, but I'm extremely proud to be the first one to actually make it to college. No one before me made it out of high school. Growing up in rural Texas, my parents worked in a cotton mill. During the summers, my brothers and I were too young to work there, so we'd pick cotton in the fields. People picked cotton in the last century? I quickly do the math in my head, wondering if this was possible. So there I am, on top of the world at the University of Arizona. My parents don't have money to pay tuition, so I find a job at a copper mine. I don't know if OSHA existed back then, but if they visited that mine, they would have shut it down. It was dangerous and filthy. He points at his left ear, saying, I lost most of my hearing in this ear when some explosives went off too close to me. I finally get my first big break when I land a job at a pipe manufacturing plant, helping with equipment maintenance. This is the first job where I'm paid to think. I study management, and more than anything, I want to go into sales after college. From what I see at the plant, those sales guys have the best jobs in the world. They get paid to wine and dine clients, and they travel from city to city, seeing what all the best factories are doing. Steve shakes his head ruefully. But that's not how it turns out. To help pay for school, I join the ROTC, where I get my first glimpse of what kids from middle-class America are like. And it means that after college, instead of going to work in industry, I have to fulfill my obligations to the U.S. Army, which is where I discover my love for logistics. I make sure materials get to where they need to. Soon, I have a reputation of being the go-to guy when you really need just about anything. I'm riveted. Steve's a good storyteller. But it's hard being a poor country hick, surrounded by people from privileged families. I feel like I need to prove myself to everyone. I'm 25 years old, and I still have fellow officers constantly calling me dumb and slow because of my accent and upbringing, he says, as his voice cracks slightly. It makes me even more determined to prove myself. After 9 years, I'm ready to leave the Army after a distinguished career. Right before I'm discharged, my commanding officer tells me something that changes my life. He says that although I've gotten consistently high ratings over the years, without exception, none of the people who served under me would want to work with me again. He tells me that if there were an Asshole of the Decade award, I'd win by a wide margin. And that if I want to make something of myself, I need to get this fixed. In the corner of my eye, I see Wes roll his eyes at Chris, who pointedly ignores him. I know what you're thinking, Steve says, nodding at Wes. But it's one of the most crushing moments of my life, and I realize that I've made a critical mistake in how I was living my life, betraying my own values. Over the next 3 decades, I became a constant student of building great teams that really trust one another. I did this first as a materials manager, then later as a plant manager, as head of marketing, and later as head of sales operations. Then, 12 years ago, Bob Strauss, our CEO at the time, hired me to become the new COO. Steve exhales slowly, rubbing his face, suddenly looking very tired and old. Somehow, I've made the wrong turn again, just like I did in the Army. I've become that person I promised myself I'd never be again. He stops talking and looks around the room. The silence goes on for a long time as we watch him stare out the window. The bright sun is starting to stream in through the conference room windows. Steve says, "We have big problems in front of us that we need to fix. Eric is right. IT is not just a department. IT is a competency that we need to gain as an entire company. And I know that if we can reforge ourselves into a great team, where we can all trust one another, we can succeed." He then says, "Are you guys willing to do what it takes to help create a team where we can all trust one another?" Steve looks around the table. I see that everyone is looking back at him with rapt attention. The silence lengthens uncomfortably. Chris is the first to speak. "I'm in. Working in a screwed-up team sucks, so if you're offering to help fix it, I'm all for it." I see Patty and Wes also nodding, and then everyone turns to look at me. Chapter 19. Tuesday, September 23rd. At last, I nod too. Patty says,
"You know, Bill, I think you've done a fantastic job in the past couple of weeks, and I'm sorry for how I reacted when you quit. I've seen such a difference in how the entire IT organization works. This is an organization that has resisted adopting any sort of process and had real problems with trust between departments. It's amazing to see, and I give most of the credit to you."
"I'm with her. I suppose I'm glad you're back too, you big quitter," Wes laughs loudly. "Whatever I might have said on that first day, I don't want your job. We need you here."
Embarrassed, I just smile. acknowledging their remarks but not wanting them to blather on, saying, "Okay, thanks, guys." Steve nods, watching our interaction. At last, he says, "Let's go around the table and have each of you share something from your personal history. Where were you born? How many siblings did you have, and where did you fit in? What childhood events helped form you as an adult?" Steve continues, "The goal of this exercise is to get to know one another as people. You've learned a bit about me and my vulnerabilities, but that's not enough. We need to know more about one another, and that creates the basis for trust." He looks around. "Who wants to go first?" Oh, shit. Marines don't like this kind of touchy-feely stuff. I immediately avert my eyes, not wanting to be called on first. Much to my relief, Chris volunteers. He starts off. "I was born in Beirut as the youngest of three children. Before the age of 18, I had lived in 8 different countries. As a result, I speak 4 languages." Chris tells us about how he and his wife tried for 5 years to have children, the agony of having to administer the fertility treatment injections to her, and just not being able to go through it a third time. Then he tells about the miracle of having identical twin boys, only to have complications, and having to stay with his wife in the intensive care unit for 3 months after they were born prematurely, and spending night after night praying that they would be okay, and not wanting one twin to live his life without the other when they were destined to be able to understand each other in a way that no other person in the world could. And how this experience taught him how selfish he was, and his newfound desire to be unselfish. To my surprise, I blink back tears, seeing Chris's earnest aspirations for his kid's future. I furtively notice others doing the same. "Thank you for sharing, Chris," says Steve solemnly after a moment, and then looks around the room. "Who's next?" To my surprise and relief, Wes goes next. I learn that he's been engaged 3 times in his life, and at the last minute, called off each one. And when he finally does get married, he quickly got divorced because she was tired of his maniacal car racing habit. How can a guy who weighs nearly 250 pounds race cars? Wes has 4 cars, and even if he weren't a Parts Unlimited employee, he would be one of our most fanatic customers. He spends most of his off hours working on his Mazda Miata and old Audi that he races competitively almost every weekend. Apparently, he's struggled with a lifelong battle to lose weight, even as a young child. He talked about being the outcast. He still battles his weight. Not to make friends or for his health, but to try to keep up with the skinny Asian teenage car racers half his age, even going to weight loss camp, 2x. There is a long silence. I'm too nervous to laugh. Steve finally says, "Thanks for sharing, Wes. Who's next?" I purse my lips together and am again relieved when Patty raises her hand. We learn that she was actually an art major. She's one of those people I've made fun of all my life, but she seems so reasonable. She tells us what it's like growing up being the smart girl with big boobs and glasses, trying to decide what to do in life. She switched majors 5 times in college, dropping out to become a singer-songwriter in Athens, Georgia, spending 2 years touring clubs around the country with her band. She went back to get her MFA, but after confronting the potential poverty of making a living as an artist, applied to work at Parts Unlimited. She almost didn't get the job because of a civil disobedience arrest that was still on her record. When Patty stops talking, Steve thanks her. And then, smiling at my discomfort, he says, "Thank you. That leaves you, Bill." Even though I've known this moment is coming, the room seems to fade out. I hate talking about myself. In the Marines, I was able to create a persona where I could just yell at people and tell them what needed to be done. I got paid to keep my people alive by being slightly smarter than they were and having great vocal cords. I do not share my feelings with work colleagues, or with almost anyone for that matter. I look at the notepad in front of me, where I've been writing down ideas of what to share. All I see is nervous doodling. The silence is nearly absolute, with everyone now looking at me expectantly. Not impatiently, I see. Instead, they seem patient and kind. I see Patty's expression turn sympathetic. I purse my lips together for a moment, and then just blurt out, "What influenced me most? When I realized that my mom did everything for us, and that my dad was completely undependable. He was an alcoholic, and when things weren't going well, all my brothers and sisters hid from him. But it got to a point where I finally had enough, and ran away. And I left them behind. And my youngest sister was only 8 years old. I keep going. You know, getting arrested was one of the best things that ever happened to me. The alternative was having to go home, so instead I joined the Marines. That introduced me to an entirely new world, where I learned that there was a totally different way of living your life. It taught me that you could be rewarded by doing things right and taking care of your fellow soldiers. What did I learn? That my main goal is to be a great father, not like the shitty father I had. I want to be the man that my sons deserve. I feel tears starting to fall down my cheeks, which I wipe away, angry that my body is betraying me. "That good enough for you, Steve?" I say with a lot more anger than I had intended. Steve nods with a half smile, saying slowly, "Thank you, Bill. I know that was as difficult for you as it was for all of us." I exhale slowly and breathe deeply one more time, trying to regain some equilibrium that I hadn't realized I'd lost. The uncomfortable silence goes on. "I know this isn't my place to say, Bill," Wes says slowly, "but I'm pretty sure your dad would be incredibly proud of you, and he would realize what a total piece of shit he was compared to you." I hear laughter around the table, and Patty says quietly, "I agree with Wes. Those kids of yours are luckier than they'll ever know." Wes grunts in agreement, and Chris nods at me, and I find myself crying for the first time in over 30 years. Embarrassed, I pull myself together and look up at everyone. I'm relieved to see everyone shifting mental gears and turning their attention back to Steve, who looks around the room. "First, I'd like to thank all of you for giving of yourself and doing that exercise with me," he says. "Although it's nice to get to know each of you better, I wouldn't do this if I didn't think it was important. Solving any complex business problem requires teamwork, and teamwork requires trust. Lencioni teaches that showing vulnerability helps create a foundation for that. I know it's unrealistic to think we're going to leave this meeting knowing exactly what we need to do, with priorities and owners assigned," he continues, "but I would like to have a joint vision as we move toward a solution." Steve puts both hands in front of him and says, "Just to get the ball rolling, I'd like to propose that one of our main problems is that we blow every commitment and schedule that we make. People outside of IT are always grumbling that we miss whatever expectations we set, by a mile." "Which makes me think," he says, looking around the room, "that we're probably not good at making internal commitments to one another here within IT. Thoughts?" Uncomfortable silence. "Look, I don't want to split hairs," Chris finally says defensively, "but if you look at the actual metrics, my group has delivered almost every project on time. We make our dates."
"Yeah, just like you hit the Phoenix date, right?" Wes says, jeering. "Now that was a huge success. I heard Steve was really proud of your performance last week."
Chris turns red, raising both hands in front of him. "That's not what I meant." He thinks for a moment, adding, "It was a total disaster, but
Technically, we did hit the date.
Interesting.
If that's true, I say, digging in, there's something really wrong with our definition of what a completed project is. If it means, did Chris get all his Phoenix tasks done, then it was a success. But if we wanted Phoenix in production that fulfilled the business goals without setting the entire business on fire, we should call it a total failure.
Let's stop pussyfooting here, Steve interrupts. I've told Sarah that Phoenix was one of the worst executed projects in the history of our company. What's a better definition of success?
Thinking for a moment, I finally say, I don't know, but this is a recurring pattern. Chris's group never factors in all the work that operations needs to do, and even when they do, they use up all the time in the schedule, leaving none for us. And we're always left cleaning up the mess long afterward.
Chris nods understandingly.
Well, you and I are fixing some of this. Part of it is a planning and architecture issue, which you and I have talked about fixing. But you're underestimating how much of a bottleneck your group is. We've got a bunch of other applications that need to be deployed, but because your team is tied up, all the other deployments waiting in line get delayed as well.
He adds, on any given week, we've got 5 or 6 application groups waiting in line for your group to deploy something or another. And when anything goes wrong, everything gets stacked up. No offense, but when you guys are late, it's like an airport that closes down. Before you know it, you have a bunch of airplanes circling, all waiting to land.
Wes grumbles loudly.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when the airplane you've built crash lands, totally destroying the runway.
Then Wes raises a placating hand.
Look, I'm not blaming you, Chris. I'm just stating a well-known fact. When deployments don't go as planned, whether the plan was written by your group or mine, it affects everybody else. That's all I'm saying.
I nod, agreeing with Wes's characterization. And surprisingly, Chris is nodding as well. I reply, Eric has helped me understand that there are 4 types of IT operations work. Business projects, IT operations projects, changes, and unplanned work. But we're only talking about the first type of work, and the unplanned work that gets created when we do it wrong. We're only talking about half the work we do in IT operations.
I turn to look at Steve, saying,
I showed you our project list. On top of the 35 business projects, we've got another 75 or so ops projects we're working. We've got a backlog of thousands of changes that apparently all need to execute for some reason or another. On top of that, we have an ever-increasing amount of unplanned work, mostly caused by all our fragile applications breaking, which includes Phoenix.
I say flatly, we are way over capacity given the amount of work in front of us, and we haven't even counted properly the big audit finding remediation project yet, which Steve says is still top priority.
I see the understanding start to dawn on Steve and Chris. Speaking of which, I look around, puzzled.
Hey, where's John? If we're talking about compliance, shouldn't he be here too? And isn't he a part of the IT leadership team as well?
Wes groans softly, rolling his eyes, saying,
Oh, great. That's just who we need.
Steve looks startled. He looks at the index card he was holding earlier. Then he runs his finger down a printed calendar in front of him.
Shit. I forgot to invite him.
Chris mutters,
Well, we were getting so much done, it was probably a blessing in disguise, right?
There's more uncomfortable laughter, but people seem embarrassed that we're making fun of John without him here.
No, that's not what I meant, Steve says quickly, looking most embarrassed of all. Bill is right. We need him here.
Everyone, let's take a 15-minute break. I'm going to have Stacy track him down.
I decide to take a walk to clear my head. When I return in 10 minutes, I see the strewn remains of a corporate meeting in progress, styrofoam cups half filled with coffee, plates of leftover food, crumpled up napkins.
Across the room, Patty and Wes are having an animated discussion with Chris. At the other end of the table, Steve is talking on his cell phone with someone, while Eric looks at the pictures of automotive parts hanging on the wall. I'm considering joining Patty and Wes when I see John walk in the room. Underneath his arm, of course, is the black three-ring binder.
"Stacy said you were looking for me, Steve," he said.
He makes a point of looking around slowly at the evidence of a meeting started without him long ago.
Did I miss a meeting notice? Or did I just get left out from yet another one?
As almost everyone goes to extraordinary lengths to avoid eye contact with him, he says even more loudly, "Hey, it smells like people just had sex in here. Did I miss anything good?" Chris, Patty, and Wes break off their conversation, and with exaggerated nonchalance, grab their original seats.
"Ah, good, you're here. I'm glad you could make it," says Steve, appearing completely unfazed. "Please grab a seat. Everyone, let's get started again."
"John, my apologies for not sending you an invite. It's completely my fault," Steve says, as he makes his way to the head of the table. "I organized this meeting yesterday at the last minute, right after the audit committee meeting. After recognizing my part in making all the IT problems worse, I wanted to assemble the IT leadership team to see if we could agree on a general direction of the solution to the issues we're having around projects, operational stability, and compliance." John looks at me questioningly, lifting an eyebrow. I'm curious at Steve's omission of the vulnerability exercise and all that. Probably he figured if he can't redo it, he might as well not even bring it up. I nod reassuringly at John. Steve turns to me. "Bill, please continue." "When you brought up the word commitment, it reminded me of something Eric asked me last week that stuck with me," I say. "He asked, on what basis do we decide whether we can accept a new project? When I said that I didn't know, he took me on another tour of MRP-8 manufacturing plant. He took me to Allie, the manufacturing resource planning coordinator, and asked her how she decides on whether to accept a new order." I flip back to my notes. "She said that she would first look at the order and then look at the bill of materials and routings. Based on that, she would look at the loadings of the relevant work centers in the plant and then decide whether accepting the order would jeopardize any existing commitments." Eric asked me how we made the same type of decision in IT, I recall. I told him then, and I'll tell you now, I don't know. I'm pretty sure we don't do any sort of analysis of capacity and demand before we accept work, which means we're always scrambling, having to take shortcuts, which means more fragile applications in production, which means more unplanned work and firefighting in the future. So around and around we go. To my surprise, Eric interrupts.
"Well put, Bill. You've just described technical debt that is not being paid down. It comes from taking shortcuts, which may make sense in the short term, but like financial debt, the compounding interest costs grow over time. If an organization doesn't pay down its technical debt, every calorie in the organization can be spent just paying interest, in the form of unplanned work. As you know, unplanned work is not free," he continues. "Quite the opposite. It's very expensive, because unplanned work comes at the expense of..." He looks around professorially for an answer. Wes finally speaks up.
"Planned work? Yes, that's exactly right, Chester. Bill mentioned the four types of work: business projects, IT operations projects, changes, and unplanned work. Left unchecked, technical debt will ensure that the only work that gets done is unplanned work."
"That sure sounds like us," Wes says, nodding.
He then looks firmly at Eric, saying,
"And it's Wes, not Chester. I'm Wes."
"Yes, I'm sure you are," Eric says agreeably.
He addresses the rest of the room.
"Unplanned work has another side effect. When you spend all your time firefighting, there's little time or energy left for planning. When all you do is react,
There's not enough time to do the hard mental work of figuring out whether you can accept new work. So, more projects are crammed onto the plate, with fewer cycles available to each one, which means more bad multitasking, more escalations from poor code, which mean more shortcuts. As Bill said, around and around we go. It's the IT capacity death spiral. I smile to myself at Eric mangling Wes's name. I'm not sure what kind of mental game he's playing, but it's amusing to watch. Uncertain, I ask Steve, are we even allowed to say no? Every time I've asked you to prioritize or defer work on a project, you've bitten my head off. When everyone is conditioned to believe that no isn't an acceptable answer, we all just become compliant order takers, blindly marching down a doomed path. I wonder if this is what happened to my predecessors, too. Wes and Patty nod slightly. Even Chris nods.
Of course you can say no, Steve replies heatedly, with a look of genuine irritation on his face.
He then takes a deep breath before saying,
Let me be clear. I need you to say no. We cannot afford to have this leadership team be order takers. We pay you to think, not just do.
Steve looks increasingly angry, saying,
What's at stake here is the survival of the company. The outcomes of these projects dictate whether this company succeeds or fails.
He looks right at me.
If you, or for that matter, anyone knows that a project will fail, I need you to say so, and I need it backed up with data. Give me data like that plant coordinator showed you, so we can understand why. Sorry, Bill, I like you a lot, but saying no just based on your gut is not enough.
Eric snorts and mutters,
That's some pretty nice soaring rhetoric, Steve. Very moving. But you know what your problem is? You guys in the business are punch drunk on projects, taking on new work that doesn't have a prayer of succeeding.
Why?
Because you have no idea what capacity you actually have. You're like the guy who is always writing checks that bounce because you don't know how much money you have and never bother opening your mail. Let me tell you a story, he says. Let me tell you about what that MRP-8 plant was like before I arrived. Those poor bastards would get these manila envelopes that would just show up, containing all sorts of crazy orders. The business would make absurd commitments to ship something at some impossible date, oblivious to all the work already in the system, he continues. It was a nightmare every day. They had inventory piled up to the ceiling.
And was there a systematic way to get WIP through the plant?
Hell no! What got worked on was based on who yelled the loudest or most often, who could engineer the best side deals with the expediters, or who could get the ear of the highest-ranking executive.
Eric is as animated as I've ever seen him.
We started restoring sanity when we figured out where our constraint was. Then we protected it, making sure that time on the constraint was never wasted. And we did everything to make sure work flowed through it.
Eric then grows still and merely says,
To fix your problem, you need to do a lot more than just learning how to say no. That's the tip of the iceberg.
We all look at him, waiting for him to keep going. But instead, he stands up, walks to his suitcase, and opens it, revealing a jumble of clothes, a snorkel, a garbage bag, and boxer shorts. He starts digging, takes out a granola bar, closes the suitcase, and returns to the table. We all watch as he opens up the granola bar package and starts eating it. Steve, looking as mystified as the rest of us, eventually says,
Eric, that's an intriguing story. Please keep going.
Eric sighs.
No, that's all I intended to say. If you can't figure out from that what you need to do, then there's really not much hope for any of you.
Steve slaps the table, exasperated. But my mind is racing. What we need to do isn't merely to prioritize better. I've already learned what the priorities are, however inconvenient. Phoenix, making the audit findings go away, all while keeping everything running. We think we know where the constraint is. It's Brent. Brent.
and we've already taken steps to protect Brent from unplanned work. I know I can't hire more resources. I also know that the workload in my organization is totally out of control. No amount of heroics on my part can make a big dent in the tidal wave of work that's been allowed to get into the system, because no one ever said no. Our mistakes were made long before it came to me. The mistakes were made by accepting the project and all the resulting shortcuts that Chris had to make before it reached me. How can we reverse this insanity? Then a strange idea hits me. I think about it for another moment. It sounds utterly absurd, yet I can't find any flaws in the logic. I say, "Steve, I have an idea, but please let me finish telling you the entire idea before you react." And I tell them what I'm thinking. Steve is the first to speak. "You must be out of your right mind," Steve says, his initial disbelief turning into exasperation. "You want to just stop doing work? Who do you think we are? Subsidized potato farmers paid not to grow crops?" But before I can respond, John speaks up. "I agree. Your idea seems like exactly the wrong thing to do. We've got a burning platform right now to finally do the right thing. We need to strike while the iron is hot. This is a perfect storm for us to finally get the budget we need to not only do the right things, but do the right things right." He starts rattling off the points on his fingers. "We've got the audit finding that has board visibility, the high visibility project that can't fail, and an operational failure that can't happen again either. We should pour on the gas and put in the security controls we need, once and for all." Wes interjects, chortling to John. "I'm stunned. I thought you would love Bill's idea. I mean, you love stopping things from getting done and saying no, right? This would be like a dream come true for you." John turns bright red, obviously preparing a scathing reply. But Wes puts his big, meaty hand on his shoulder and says with a smile, "Hey, I'm just kidding, okay? Just making a joke." Everyone starts talking at once when Eric suddenly stands up, crumples his granola bar wrapper, and throws it across the room into the wastebasket, missing it completely. He leans back in his chair, saying, "Bill, I think your proposal is very astute." Looking at John, he continues, "Remember, Jimmy, the goal is to increase the throughput of the entire system, not just increase the number of tasks being done. And if you don't have a trustworthy system of work, why should I trust your system of security controls? Bah! A total waste of time." John looks back at Eric, puzzled. "What?" Eric sighs and rolls his eyes. Instead of responding to John, he turns his gaze to Steve. "You've been a plant manager. Think of it as freezing materials release until enough WIP completes and leaves the plant. In order to control this system, we need to reduce the number of moving parts." When Steve doesn't appear convinced, Eric leans forward in his chair and asks him pointedly, "Suppose you're managing the MRP-8 plant, and you have inventory piled to the ceiling. What would happen if you stopped releasing jobs and materials onto the plant floor?" Surprised to be the target of the question, Steve considers it for a moment.
"The amount of WIP in the plant goes down,
because work will start leaving the plant as finished goods."
"Correct," Eric says, nodding approvingly.
"And what will likely happen to due date performance?"
"Due date performance goes up because WIP went down," Steve says, looking increasingly suspicious and reluctant about where Eric might be leading him.
"Yes, very good," Eric says encouragingly. "But on the other hand, what happens to inventory levels if you allow the plant to continue to accept orders and release new jobs?"
he says after a moment.
"WIP goes up."
"Excellent," Eric says. "And what happens to due date performance?"
Steve looks like he's just swallowed something that isn't agreeing with him, and he says eventually,
"Everyone knows that in manufacturing, as WIP increases, due date performance goes down."
"Wait a minute here,"
he says, squinting at Eric. You're not actually suggesting that this applies to IT, too. That by halting all work except for Phoenix, we'll reduce the amount of WIP in IT, and that this will somehow improve due date performance? Is that seriously what you're suggesting? Eric leans back in his chair, looking pleased with himself.
Yes.
Wes says,
Won't that leave most of us just twiddling our thumbs with nothing to do? That's 130 people in IT operations just sitting around. Doesn't that sound a bit wasteful?
Eric scoffs and says,
I'll tell you about wasteful. How about over 1,000 changes stuck in the system, with no apparent way of ever getting them completed?
Wes frowns. Then he nods, saying,
That's true. The number of cards on Patty's change board keep going up. If that's work in process, it's definitely spiraling out of control. We're probably only a couple weeks away from having those cards stacked to the ceiling, too.
I nod. He's right. The idea is for IT operations and development to not accept any new projects for 2 weeks and to stop all work in IT operations except for work related to Phoenix. I look around. If we single task on the most important project for 2 weeks and still aren't able to make a big dent, then I think we should all find new day jobs.
Chris nods. I think we should give it a shot. We'll keep working on the other active projects, but we'll freeze all deployment work except Phoenix. From Bill's perspective, it will look like that's the only thing we're working on. Make no mistake, Phoenix will be everyone's top priority.
Patty and Wes nod in agreement. John crosses his arms.
I'm not sure if I can support this insane proposal. First, I've never seen any organization do anything even remotely like this before. Second, I'm very concerned that if we do this, we'll lose our shot at getting all the audit issues fixed. As Steve already said, those audit findings could kill the company too.
You know what your problem is, Eric says, pointing a finger at John. You never see the end-to-end business process, so I guarantee you that many of the controls you want to put in aren't even necessary.
John says,
What?
Again, Eric waves John's question away.
Don't worry about it for now. Let the inevitable happen, and we'll see what we can learn from it.
Steve turns to John.
I understand your concerns about security. But the biggest risk to the company is not the unresolved audit findings. The biggest risk to the company is that we don't survive. We need Phoenix to regain competitive parity.
He pauses and says, Let's give this project freeze 1 week and see if it makes a difference in the Phoenix work. If we don't, we'll put the remediation work back on the front burner. Okay?
John nods reluctantly. He then flips to a page in his three-ring binder and makes some notes. He's probably recording Steve's promise.
Steve, we definitely need your help to make this happen, I say. My guys are routinely strong-armed into doing pet projects by almost every manager in this company. I think we need an email from you to the entire company, not only explaining why you're doing this, but what the consequences will be if someone tries to put unauthorized work into the system.
Eric makes an encouraging noise.
No problem, Steve quickly replies. I'll send you all a draft after this meeting. Revise it, and I'll send it out to all the company managers. Good enough for you?
Trying to keep the disbelief out of my voice, I say,
Yes.
It's astonishing what we agree to in the next hour. IT operations will freeze all non-Phoenix work. Development can't idle the 20-plus non-Phoenix projects, but will freeze all deployments. In other words, no work will flow from development to IT operations for another 2 weeks. Furthermore, we will identify the top areas of technical debt, which development will tackle to decrease the unplanned work being created by problematic applications in production. This will all make a huge difference in my team's workload. Furthermore, Chris and Kirsten will review all Phoenix tasks not being worked
and steal resources from other projects to get them in work again. Everyone seemed energized and excited to put the plan into place, even John. Before we all leave, Steve says, "Thank you all for your good thinking today and for sharing something about yourself. I feel like I know all of you better now." And, as unbelievable as I think Bill's crazy project freeze idea is, I think it could work. I look forward to this being the first of many great decisions this team will make. As I said, one of my goals is that we will create a team where we can all trust one another, he continues. Hopefully, we made a small step in that direction. And I encourage you to keep demanding honest and truthful communications between you. He looks around the room and asks, "Is there anything that you guys need from me in the meantime?" There are no requests, so we adjourn. As we all get up to leave, Eric says loudly,
"Great work, Bill. Couldn't have done it better myself."